everybody, and welcome to a brand new episode of the Retro Raw Rundown here on Inside Ropes. My name is Kenny McIntosh, joined as always when we do the retro shows by Sondra. Hi Sondra, how are you?
Hi Kenny, I'm doing pretty well. The cold has kind of like broken a little bit in Michigan. It is currently a balmy 35 degrees, which is above zero for you. And I'm really excited about that. So that just puts me in a better mood. And also this episode of Raw was bonkers and they go to Texas and Mankind is explaining business to Kurgan. And what even is happening?
It's like minus five here just now. Somewhat like that.
Oh, okay.
But, I mean, the thing is, America have now come out of a peace treaty with Russia on nuclear bombs, and Russia have come out of it as well, so we might not make another Christmas, everybody.
We'll see what happens. No, it cracked me up this past week when Michael Fair sent me on Twitter. He's like, so, you know, because like the entire state of Michigan, the government was shut down because of the cold and the snow and everything this week, because it was really insane. And he's like, so I just had to do like a news break about your crazy shutdown and stuff on, you know, on my radio show. And he sent me the break and it's pretty funny. He's like, you know, so they just came out of a government shutdown over in America and now it's a polar vortex and everyone is freezing to death. Like, okay. Awesome. Glad to know that, you know, even across the world where it's like 100 some degrees, we're making news for all sorts of things. But yeah, it's broken a little bit. I'm going to a wrestling show this afternoon in Indiana. I should be able to make it there, which is good. So I'm really looking forward to that.
There we go. Well, this episode was pretty interesting one to talk about. February the 1st, 1999. But before that, Sondra, you did what you've never done before. You delved into a full episode of Heat.
I did. I think I've done that one time before, but I'm not going to lie, I did fast forward through some of, was it Big Boss Man versus someone?
Boss Man versus Jarrett and Shamrock versus Owen with the two matches that they put on.
Yes. In the arena. I did not pay rapt attention to Boss Man versus Jarrett, if I'm being perfectly honest, but
it was bad.
It did not seem great, so I wandered out of the room and made tea.
What you did miss was that Big Boss Man was able to resist the charms of Deborah, so the saltpeter seems to have worked.
Delayed effect of saltpeter? Maybe it just takes a few days? Baffling.
Baffling.
Absolutely baffling.
Let's just talk about the two things on Heat that... Because I said to you, this might be an episode to catch.
Mm-hmm. I would not have turned it on if you wouldn't have told me about it.
So last week we saw the heel turn of China, and then it was kind of like, one of your questions was, well, why? Like, it just kind of came out of nowhere. And one of the reasons that I thought might be quite good for you to watch is because China gives her explanation on Heat as to why she turned on DX and joined the corporation. I thought it was a pretty great explanation, actually, of why she did it, and it kind of made sense within the story, and they brought up stuff where, like, you wouldn't have thought of it before, maybe, but then now that she's bringing it up in a promo, it works. So I thought it worked pretty well. What did you make of China's promo and her reasoning and the kind of why China, why outcome?
I mean, China's awesome. The more I think about it, and I was thinking about this kind of a lot yesterday after I was watching Retro Raw, I don't agree with the idea of turning China and having her join the corporation at this point, because I feel like there are so many turns that are happening so constantly that it cheapens it. I mean, she's someone who obviously has a longstanding history with DX, and her turning is shocking, but the impact of it was a little bit less for me just because so many people have turned and joined the corporation or not joined the corporation, and like Kane's there, and like the corporation already has enough people, right? But it does make for an interesting story, and I think China's explanation was very good. I really liked when she was getting the microphone to speak. She's like, oh, a microphone, a chance to speak. This is new, you know, because she doesn't get a chance to speak in DX very often. She stands there and is statuesque and amazing. But I mean, basically she says that, you know, she was the one who carried DX. She was the one who was, you know, the kind of the guiding force behind the group. And she didn't really get anything out of it. They didn't support her. They weren't necessarily there for her. They treated her like she was less because she's a woman, essentially, was the implication. She's like, you know, because I'm not a dude. They're like, oh, well, China's kind of over in the corner. She can do all the work for us, but not really get a lot of the benefits of being in the group. You know, she's not getting title shots. She's not getting that kind of stuff. She didn't say title shots because she really isn't wrestling all that much right now. But I mean, and then like she gives this explanation about how she felt kind of like outcast and, you know, a bit downtrodden in DX and people weren't really respecting her and that kind of stuff. And it's like, okay, I kind of understand that. And she's like, you know, and so she did kind of sell out for the money, right? Like she found a cult leader who is taking in all kinds of outcast people. I mean, I said to you last night, it's very interesting to me that The Undertaker and Vince McMahon are both essentially cult leaders who are taking on outcasts, and Vince McMahon is doing way better at it than The Undertaker, question mark. Like, it's just, it's a very baffling world in 1999. But China's like, you know, she wasn't getting the respect she deserved. And Vince McMahon had something for her, was like, all right, we'll take care of you. We'll let you be part of our group and I'll pay you well. And she's like, okay, well, I'm going to do this for myself. And I need to, you know, I need to advance my career and I need to move on and up in the world. So fine, you know, like fine rationale. And then when Triple H comes out and is basically like, you don't have a penis, I was like, I'm on her side.
So one of the things I've been thinking about when we've been watching this is that it appears that they just made this decision in like late 98 of like, we're going to push China now. Like that's what they're going to do because she's very popular. Mm-hmm. And what's interesting is that, you know, I'll use you as an example. You're a big fan of China, right?
I really like her.
But what I remember happening is that over the next 12 months, they kind of ruin her. Not through like, she doesn't do anything as a character that's bad, but they kind of take away a lot of what makes her special.
Mm-hmm.
Like, she is a less is more type character, you know, like, and they make her a more is more type character. And then, you know, she ends up becoming a wrestler. And then what really gets it over the following year is a storyline that doesn't really involve her being a wrestler, which I'm fine with. But, you know, so they clearly made this choice. They want to push her in late 98, and they do this whole story that leads to the Rumble, where she's going to be in the Rumble. And I guess from their point of view, they must have thought, well, what do we do with her now? If she goes back into DX, we've already just done a love interest story with her, where she gets her one up in the end on this guy or whatever. And then we do the Rumble story. So what more, I guess maybe they thought the more interesting story to tell was her turning. But I liked her explanation. I've never seen this promo because I never saw Heat. So to me, this makes more sense now because of her promo than it did when I was watching when I was younger, because I didn't see it when I was younger.
I mean, I guess one of my issues with it is kind of that the motivation is very generic, right? Like, I mean, it makes sense and I liked her explanation, but I feel like it really could have been any character on the show and didn't necessarily have to be specific to China.
Because it's not like they've done a long-term... I mean, but this is maybe one of the things where... So, you know, like on SmackDown just now... The China thing is much more effective. I'm not making a comparison, so don't worry. But like the, you know, the Mandy Rose Naomi thing, they've whoever in the fucking archives found that tough enough footage and spliced it together the way they did deserves a raise. But they've brought back this thing from years ago that was never intended to be a thing. Whereas with China, if they decide, right, we're going to turn her, the decision was probably only like 2-3 weeks old, if that. Mm-hmm. So it's not like they'd been building this for 6 months and put these little subtle things in there. So they had to come up with some reasons that they could use. So I think with what they had, they did the best job that they could.
But I mean, that's just the issue of they didn't have a lot of story details. Like, they didn't have China really being left by DX all that much. Because, I mean, I was trying to justify why China's not the bad guy. And I was like, where were they when she was having trouble with Mark Henry? You're like, Triple H tried to fight Mark Henry for her. So did Waltman. I was like, oh, that's right. They did. I forgot because I don't pay that much attention to DX. But, you know, I mean, there really wasn't any hint that things were going poorly. I mean, I would compare this kind of to when Seth Rollins turned on the Shield, right? Because that's another longstanding group, and it was someone who you thought was, you know, integral to the fabric of the Shield turning right when you didn't expect it. But there were seeds of dissension within the Shield, and there also seemed to be a little bit more motivation for it because Seth Rollins was able to join the Authority, and I think it was more effective when Seth Rollins did it because, I mean, first of all, the Authority and Evolution and all that, like, they didn't have such a huge cast of characters already. Like, China just seems like another person in the corporation. She doesn't seem like she's a ringer because they already have a bodyguard and they already have like a kick-ass crazy man and they already have a monster who I don't understand why he's still with them because they call him terrible things. So it's just, it's almost like the cast of the corporation is getting too big for me. And her explanation was good. And I like her bringing gender into it some, you know, she's kind of like, you know, because I don't remember if she said outright, because I'm not a man, they treat me like I'm less than them, but that seemed to be kind of what she was implying. And then, you know, when Triple H comes out and essentially confirms that he's a cretin, was very infuriating to me. Well, I mean, seriously though, if she's like, all right, so I'm a woman and I'm being treated like I'm less in the group, what should your response to that be?
Well,
It probably should not be like, China, you've always wanted balls and you don't have them.
but the problem is the tri if the Triple H character had come out and said the truth, like, we were always behind you. That's like that. There's nothing there. You've just killed
I think there is something there, because that would build a lot more sympathy for DX. Like, if Triple H is like, you know, we were always behind you and this is how you treat us, okay, then war is on, right? Like, then we are going to go to battle because you have broken my heart.
I mean, this is a group whose motto is suck it.
I'm aware.
We're
I'm not
not gonna
expecting
have
high things of DX. I'm just saying that they are confirming that they are cretins to me and I am not on their side.
I understand that. I thought it was done well though. I like it. I mean one of the problems that you have with this is that you can't really build to a Triple H versus China match. I mean you
Right.
can, but like
I mean, that would be the logical outcome. And at this point, like, even we see on this episode of Raw, when she gets in the cage and gets involved and all that kind of stuff, she has no aptitude for professional wrestling. Like, she is a great character and she's very good at like kind of short and to the point spots, but
But that's an
when it
example
comes
of.
to actually like fluid motion in a ring, she's just not very good at it.
But that's, you know, the example we talk about women in wrestling today. And, like, there's space for different types of characters. And one of my big problems last year with Lana was that she's not a good professional wrestler. And she has tried, I'm sure, very hard for a while. Now, I could try playing the guitar, and I could really put work into it. But I think you either have the aptitude for something or you don't. And you if you do have the aptitude for it, then the training and the skill and whatever is going to come. But sometimes you just don't. And I think that's nothing to be like, it's nothing to be sad about. So like, with China is a great example of she did not belong being a wrestler, but she belonged doing every single thing around that, getting
Yeah, like
involved in
she belongs
matches,
in wrestling, but not
physicality.
having long wrestling matches.
Yeah, exactly. So, and we're you know, but I mean, I like the storyline. I think the China heel turn was quite shocking, but they did it in a way that they made it believable of what the story was. So I give them props for that one. But we did watch the halftime heat match, which was Mankind versus Vince McMahon, Mankind versus The Rock, sorry, with Vince McMahon on commentary. Obviously, Finn and I have covered that kind of at length on Retro Heat on Patreon. But what did you make of the halftime Heat WWF Championship match, the empty arena match, Mankind and The Rock with Vince McMahon as the commentator?
I did not expect to like this match because there are a lot of things going into it that are not up my alley, right? Like, I love Mankind. I love him as a character, but a lot of his matches lately have not been my favorites, especially because they're so brutal and I feel bad for him as a human. I'm not a big fan of The Rock. We know this. Empty arena matches are always kind of strange because you don't have the crowd to feed off of. And that's part of wrestling, right? Like, having a live crowd reaction really helps with wrestling, I feel, because it kind of helps like propel the energy and the emotion of it. But I fucking loved this match, Kenny. Like, I think it was too long for what it was. I think they maybe went into one location too many, but it was bonkers. It was a lot of fun. I'm so glad that Vince McMahon was on commentary, actually. I think he was the perfect person to do commentary. There was that bit in the kitchen where he seemed to forget that he was on commentary and just stopped speaking for a while. But like, for the most part, though, when they were in the arena, especially when they didn't have a lot of the setting to, you know, be bonkers, because they do start in the ring. Vince McMahon is just doing running commentary, and his emotion and his kind of vibe helped keep me a little bit more into it. Like, I did kind of zone out a little bit at the beginning, but then when The Rock and Mankind start brawling into, you know, the chairs area, and Mankind gets buried in chairs, and The Rock throws a chair at him or whatever, that's fine. But you know, and coming off that Royal Rumble match, there's no way that Mick Foley should be wrestling right now. So that's always kind of in the back of my head. And any sort of like headshot that Mick Foley takes, I'm like, stop doing things to your head. Your brains are scrambled. This is not healthy for you. And it's, you know, it's hard to take myself out of that. But, you know, going into the kitchen, putting Socko in the oven. The Rock was very funny in this match. I have to give him credit for it. There were so many visual actual puns, like when they're in the office and the phone rings and the Rock's like, I'm sorry, Mankind can't come to the phone right now. His mouth is currently full of my foot, and like he kicks him in the face, and then he's like, I'm sorry, Mankind's a little tied up right now, and he puts the phone cord around his neck. Like, I'm a big sucker for visual puns. I think they're hilarious. So like that kind of popped me a lot. And Vince on commentary just being a cretin the whole time, talking about how Mankind definitely said I quit and, you know, is inferior to The Rock. I think everyone played their part in this match for sure.
I should say that it was in the Observer that Vince basically wanted to be the commentator because he believed that much of the audience for this, because this was also the halftime of the Super Bowl. He believed that most people who would be watching this, or a lot of people, would be sort of channel switchers who weren't familiar with WWF. Or Mankind and The Rock. So if you go back and watch it again, he is kind of commentating it as if you don't really know who people are. And he's kind of giving you the backstory or what's going on.
Well, yeah, there's the one point in the match where he actually says the words. He's like, and for those of you tuning in the halftime of the Super Bowl and wondering, what the hell is going on? This is the first empty arena match in the World Wrestling Federation. It's halftime heat. Because they actually, I think this is very smart of them, what they did. I commend WWF for this because they aired that Super Bowl ad beforehand.
Mm-hmm.
And then got people to watch halftime heat instead of actual halftime of Super Bowl. I think it's really smart marketing.
What do you think that this episode of Halftime Heat did as a rating? So let me give you some numbers.
Well,
let me give you some other numbers of just various things and just go with that. So the Raw where Mankind won the title did a 5.5. Nitro that week did a 5.0. Last week's Heat, the Heat of the Royal Rumble did like a 4.59 or 4.79. Raw this week in 2019 did like a 2.3. What do you
think? I
mean,
what are Heat ratings normally as opposed to Raw?
Heat kind of goes with the 4 range.
Because I would guess that Halftime Heat, it's tricky because obviously so many people are going to be watching the Super Bowl. That's like, everybody always watches the Super Bowl. But I mean, there is a contingent of wrestling fans who don't watch the Super Bowl, like me, for instance, who are going to want to turn into
It's also
Heat,
on
but
during
then,
halftime.
And it's also on during halftime, which, I mean, some people care about the halftime show. Who was in the halftime of Super Bowl that year?
I will find out as you're talking.
Okay. So I'm going to guess that Halftime Heat did well. I mean, based on the ad and based on wrestling being so big in pop culture at that point, I don't know. Did it do like a 5-something? 6-something?
The halftime show. Oh, my. Who are the? Okay.
I'm really bad at ratings, but what was the halftime show for the Super Bowl?
The halftime show was a celebration of soul, salsa, and swing featuring Big Bad Voodoo Daddy, Stevie Wonder, and Gloria Estefan, and it's true, the rhythm will get you.
So I don't feel like that halftime lineup is necessarily going to compel people to stay. Like, I mean, it sounds perfectly fun to me, but it also seems like, oh, I might want to check out the wrestling, or I might want to check out something else, or go get snacks, or whatever. I don't know. I'm really bad at guessing ratings,
so
but I think it did well.
The 20-minute counter programming on the USA Network of Halftime Heat was the most watched WWF wrestling match from start to finish ever on cable.
Wow.
And the highest rated WWF television on USA in 11 years, they did a 6.59 rating.
Wow, that's really big.
Mm-hmm.
That's cool. I don't mean everyone's at their TV anyway to watch Super Bowl. It makes sense. Like, again, I think their marketing here was genius.
They did lose a lot of money in the Super Bowl ad, but, you know.
I'm sure they
there
did.
There you go.
It's a great ad, though, to be fair.
I love it so much. The only thing that is still to this day is the fact that Vince had to be, like, in a certain side to show the buildings. His hair's the wrong way around.
Oh.
Bothers me. Anyway.
I love when Kane is, like, just in the corner with a cup of coffee.
Yeah.
Just hanging out in the office, and then like a man goes over a balcony, and then later on this episode of Raw they show the ad with like, we always use sex and we love violence, and they did like
the Undertaker, we're good wholesome family entertainment. You're like, yeah. You're a ministry cult leader.
You just did a blood sacrifice. You pal about with Midian and Viscera.
Oh God. Although this is the first time, this is more for me and weird people who watch this point, this cool visual, is that we've never seen The Undertaker wrestle in that gear with that goatee before. So he's in gear of like 1998 Undertaker, but he has his ministry goatee on. So it's very jarring if you're like a close watcher of all that kind of stuff. It's like two different eras of Undertaker for this ad. But do you know what? A $42 million ad probably gets you out your clothes in the morning.
Yep.
Okay, so February 1st, 1999, Monday Night Raw. We are in Tucson, Arizona. Ever been to Tucson, Arizona, Sandra?
I've never been to Tucson, Arizona. I don't think so, no.
Okay, good. Glad we had that chat.
Yeah.
We see the halftime heat thing with Mankind the Rock, and it ends with Vince McMahon going, "Mankind has become the WWF champion with the aid of a forklift."
Which is, I mean, I can't believe we forgot to mention that. Yeah, Mankind's the champion. What? I did not know that that happened. I really didn't. And so the ending of the match, because I was like, all right, so it's, you know, it's an empty arena match. The Rock can win with some sort of shenanigans. I just expected him to stay the champion. And nope, the title switched again. Mankind's the actual champion because Mankind used a forklift with kegs on it to pin the Rock. And the Rock was making all these weird faces and like squirming about, but couldn't get his shoulders up because he was forklifted down. And I mean, just bonkers. The empty arena match is just a lot of fun.
Yeah, I'd never seen it before, Phil. And I love it. It's great. Okay, so we got Shane McMahon said backstage, you know, that Vince is on assignment in Texas, so he's in charge. Tess, Shamrock, and Kane are all there. And then Shane's like, you let Kane get to the arena on his own. And he's like, you three, I swear, if you all had a brain together, you'd be dangerous.
He calls him the R word again, the big red.
Big red retard, yeah, he calls him that.
Which I do not appreciate.
So, you know, simmering there is the idea of them using Kane. Watch this space. Shane walks out with the corporation. Vince McMahon has not given his No Chance in Hell music to his crew yet.
No, but you forgot the part where Terry and Jacqueline come in, and the big boss man is terrible to them.
So Terry and Jackie are walking through the back, and Terry and Jackie are walking through, and basically as they walk, they kind of bump into the boss man a little bit, or he bumps into them, and boss man says, "Watch where you're going, bitch." And they walk on. Now, we will get to all
that. Now, is it any wonder that they are angry? Is it any wonder that they are angry at some of the gentlemen on this show?
I mean, if you felt sorry for them right now, I feel like that may go away later.
I mean, possibly. I have no idea.
So Shane comes out with the corporation. Shane says Vince has gone to Texas to try and provoke Steve Austin into a physical confrontation, because if he does that, then Austin's void of the contract and Vince can get out of having to fight him at St. Valentine's Day Massacre. There's a steel cage. So basically Shane then says that he's got this. He tells the corporation to go to the back. He's on his own. And so the main event tonight is Triple H versus Kane in a steel cage match. The steel cage is being lowered. And what Shane doesn't know is that X-Pac is actually on top of the cage as it's lowering. Then we have DX backstage fighting with the corporation. X-Pac leaps into the ring, starts mauling Shane until China, which, wearing corporate white instead of black, I appreciate.
I appreciate the white, but I feel like the satiny material doesn't really work, and also it doesn't look supportive enough to be wrestling gear.
All accurate points. And then she comes out, runs in, gives X-Pac a low blow, tends to Shane. So I get you out of the gate. We've got our stuff set up for the night. Mankind's the champion. Shane's running the show. The corporation are there. X-Pac was trying to get some revenge on Shane. China's cemented herself as a corporation member. We've got Triple H and Kane in the main event. So I thought they did a decent job in the opening segment, just kind of setting you up of, here's our stories, here's what they're going to be as we go on. What do you think?
Yeah, it was fine. I mean, I didn't retain a ton from this opening segment because it just kind of went on. But it does make me feel kind of bad for X-Pac, because China's original turn on X-Pac too, like after he's trying to help her out and he's trying to like be the nice dude, because X-Pac's kind of like the nicer one in DX at this point, even though he's like, let's rip some ass or whatever.
Nothing wrong with ripping ass, Sandra.
Well, I mean, it sounded very painful for him. Just like China. It's one of those things where like he's been trying to be the good person to her, and he just seems baffled by the fact that she would turn on him. And so yeah, like he's trying to get some retribution, and then she just comes after him, and you know, he gets battered and broken down. So it does create some sympathy for X-Pac. I think the problem is that Triple H is such a terrible person, and he purports to be the leader of DX, and that's why I'm just like, I'm not on DX's side, because I really don't like Triple H at all. But I mean, yeah, it was a fine opening segment and it did kind of set the alignments. I'm having a little bit of an issue because as I'm watching this, like after another reason China's turn maybe didn't hit as well for me, I'm like, did she really turn or did she not? Like, I don't feel like I can trust it. I don't feel like I can trust that China's actually in the corporation or is going to be there for any length of time because the show has shown me that, you know, people will turn or have allegiances or have alliances and then be like, oh no, I was just kidding, never mind. So much like leading up to this that I'm like, I'm still kind of on edge about it. I'm like, is she really in the corporation? Does she really care about them? I don't really trust it. And
It's
so I'm
funny.
not really invested.
It's funny because like in the 90s and in the 90s there's so many turns all the time.
I mean, we get a couple more on this show.
We do. I mean, I kind of enjoy it because you're always on your feet to see what's happening. I mean, you can't really get through an episode. Has Andy turned yet? I need to know. But you know, I love shenanigans. Shenanigans are my thing. As long as there's an effort for the shenanigans to make sense, then I'm fine with it.
I love shenanigans, but it's like sometimes there are just too many of them and then they don't mean anything.
There's only
It's like,
one shenanigan in 1999, which we will get to, that bothers me because I don't think there's any way that it can make sense. Like, I'm willing to go with a lot of stuff. Like, I'm willing to go with, like, you don't need to be completely logical for me. You just need to be seen to be trying to explain it, and it's in some way plausible. Like, China, okay, I don't really buy that she was unhappy in DX, but she never did get a microphone, and she was kind of doing their dirty work for them. And she did get offered money, so like I can buy it. I can buy it enough to do it. Whereas there's one that comes later on, higher up from here, that doesn't make sense given stuff that happens to me. So that's kind of what I said on the turns thing. So
Well, it's
then.
just kind of like, you know, matches with like tons of flippy high spots and whatnot get a lot of criticism from, you know, older school professional wrestling people because they're like, if you're doing all of these flips and all of this stuff and none of it means anything, then why even bother? And that's kind of how I feel about the turns. Like they're essentially just like there are too many high spots without any justification.
Yeah, and I get it. I think for me, I feel that if you do a turn, and the China one's not an example for this, but if you do a turn where somebody's pretending to be in something for like 3 months, then I kind of like having that 3 months where you're kind of wondering, as opposed to like somebody's just the same character for a year and a half and there's nothing really interesting going on. But there's a balance for sure.
Because you
So.
need to sow seeds. I mean, it's like when Randy Orton was in the Wyatt family, there were definitely seeds of dissension, so it made sense when
Oh, he was
he, you
such
know,
a good
did the
Wyatt.
most awful thing.
He was such a good Wyatt. Why did I have to ruin it? So,
He's
Vince
a
is
cretin. Ooh.
it. We get the Super Bowl. We get told we're going to get the Super Bowl advert tonight, which is the most controversial ad ever aired during the Super Bowl. Vince has shown. Vince McMahon is in Victoria, Texas, at a bar with the Stooges. Vince is dressed as normal Vince McMahon in his suit, and Pat Patterson and Gerald Briscoe are dressed kind of like they're in a Western.
They're not dressed like they're in a Western. They're dressed like they're in a high school production of a Western.
Gerald Briscoe is wearing assless chaps with jeans underneath. He has a lasso, or a lasso, however you pronounce it, the rope thing.
A lasso.
Pat Patterson is dressed like a gay Westerner because he is, which I appreciate the continuity. Now, like, I think I was thinking about this during it, and the more that it went on, I think it's the case. Patterson has like a bit of paper in the back of his jeans, and I'm pretty sure that's like his script.
Oh, I'm sure that it is.
And
I am positive.
he like, and that's like the one they used. Imagine the stuff there was that they didn't use. So Vince tells them they look ridiculous. He then says, "Look, I'll handle this. I know
They're
how
like,
to."
we're in Texas. We need to fit in.
Yeah, so they're trying to fit in. He's like, "Look, let me deal with this."
No one else around them is dressed like this
No, no, no,
at all.
nobody. Nobody.
It's so good.
So Vince says, "I'll deal with this. I know how these people think." He walks up to a bar, the actual bar part of the establishment, and says to the lady behind the bar, calls her Toots. And then, you know, have you seen Steve Austin? She says, I reckon not. And then he just has a go at her for, like, where I come from, we either say we did or we didn't. We don't reckon.
He's like, we say yes or no, we don't reckon. And she's just like, fuck you.
So she then pulls out a baseball bat and they run away and leave.
as well she should. I mean, the hilarity of it is Vince being like, I can talk to these people. You know, it's okay. I can totally handle this. And he's so corporate up his own ass that, you know, there's no way he can talk to any of these people. And plus, what did they think was going to happen? Like, they're looking for Stone Cold Steve Austin. Presumably, if you have, you know, us believe World Wrestling Federation propaganda, everyone in the world is watching wrestling. So if these people are not only, you know, friends of Steve Austin, if these are the local establishments he frequents on a regular basis, theoretically, they've also watched the show, or they would want to watch what their pal is up to on Raw. They know who Vince McMahon is. They know that he is not to be trusted. So, I mean, really, the planning here is just flawed from Vince McMahon and Stooges.
Tremendous segment, though.
I love it. All about it. It's so good.
Then we get Val Venus taking on Badass Billy Gunn with Ken Shamrock and commentary. There's a brilliant bit where Shamrock has been asked about Ryan Shamrock maybe dating Val Venus. He's screaming that, like, he's not going to let that happen. And then he says, like, he basically says, I told my sister that I would not let him date. I would not. He says something where he's meant to say Venus. Like, so he's meant to say him, but he says her.
You know, he says, I promised my sister that I would not lay a hand on her. Yeah, and Michael Cole's just it. Like, so what you're trying to tell us is that you promised your sister that you would not lay a hand on Val Venus. Didn't you hear me, Michael Cole? Yes, I said that I promised her I would not lay a hand on him. And it's like, that's not what you said, Ken. You basically said that you wouldn't hit your sister.
Jerry Lawler calls Ken Shamrock Kenny.
Uh-huh.
You know, so there's that.
Which is aggravating to Ken Shamrock as well. Ken Shamrock does not appreciate any of Jerry Lawler's line of questioning about how Val Venus had his hands all over Ryan in the shower.
This match with Billy Gunn and Val Venus was set up last week when Val Venus attacked Billy Gunn after thinking that it was him that beat him down after his match with Test, but it wasn't. The match was so-so, but then inevitably Ken Shamrock got rage and hit Val Venus with a chair.
But didn't put his hands on him.
Didn't
hit him
put his
with
hands
a chair.
On him. I love that little, like, technicality. That was great. But then, of course, as Shamrock's retreating, Billy Gunn has the chair because he's ran Shamrock off. Venus thinks that Billy Gunn hit him, so he lays out Billy Gunn with the chair before leaving. I'm kind of digging this program with Val and Billy Gunn and Shamrock. It's pretty fun so far. I remember vaguely where things go, but I don't remember the specifics of how it goes as a story in terms of execution, so pretty looking forward to seeing it. How did this work for you? Val and Billy Gunn, they're kind of at odds because of miscommunication, and you get Ken Shamrock being very angry and shouty.
I mean, Val Venus versus Billy Gunn is a match that's actually not terrible, which is nice. But we don't see a lot of it because the camera keeps focusing on commentary, so we can just see Ken Shamrock being a terrible, terrible human who's trying to just control his sister. Like, I mean, this program is pretty fun, but I don't like the fact that I have to root against Ken Shamrock in a program where Val Venus is involved. I feel icky about it. Because
maybe
it's
1999. Maybe 1999 is going to be the year of you turning around on Val Venus. It is not. Because what I think will happen is I think that you will soften on Val Venus, then something will happen that you will be angry at him again, and that'll be that.
Well, and the thing is, I don't like Val Venus in this situation. It's not building sympathy for Val Venus. Like, the only one I really like in the program so far is Billy Gunn, because the worst he's done is just show his ass to people, and it's a nice ass, so I don't even mind. But, I mean, Val Venus is a cretin who's terrible to women. But if Ryan Shamrock wants to make poor decisions, those are her poor decisions to make. Ken Shamrock is, I mean, I'm kind of glad that it's the heel saying, like, I'm going to control my, you know, not woman, but sister, instead of it being the babyface thing to do. Because I could totally see WWF playing that as a babyface thing. Like, I want to control this woman and, you know, protect her from the dastardly ways of the world or something, because she is too fragile to live her own life. If Ryan wants to get her whole, she should get her whole. It's fine. But so Ken Shamrock is just sitting there going, like, no, there's no guy who's good enough to date my sister. And I told her she was under no circumstances allowed to date any of these wrestlers. And da 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 da. And it's like, you need to let your sister be a human. Like, if she wants to make poor decisions and go in the shower on television with Val Venus, like, she should make better choices.
That's her journey.
Because it's her journey. I mean, we've all made mistakes in the past. We've all been
Speak
with people
for
we
yourself,
shouldn't have been
Sandra.
With. You know, I think that that's a universal truth. And if Ryan Shamrock wants to make those mistakes in her young age, then she should absolutely be able to do that. And Ken Shamrock just trying to control her is very, very grating on my nerves, especially because I like Ken Shamrock so much, but I know he's the heel and I'm not supposed to like him. So that's kind of effective. Val Venus is just kind of there. And like Val Venus comes across as kind of an idiot because he just assumes that Billy Gunn has attacked him when obviously Ken Shamrock is the one who's been raging at Coventry this entire time and is angry with Val Venus. So it seems kind of like, all right, if you got hit in the back with a chair, who would you assume did it? Like, why would you assume that Billy Gunn is the one attacking you when Ken Shamrock's the one who's like, stay away from my sister, I hate you. And then you also went to the extra effort of filming yourself having sexual relations with his sister just to goad him.
Adrenaline is a strange thing.
Apparently so, and I'm sure Val Venus is just full of it. So, but I mean, Val Venus and Billy Gunn is kind of an interesting program, I guess. It seems weird because, I mean, it's not like they were like best friends or anything, but I guess they do like to show off parts of their body, so they bond over it.
Yeah, I guess so. The bonkersness continues, though. Mankind, who still has The Rock's $100,000 bounty that Vince gave him from Shane's trust fund, decides to buy Max Mini for his children, who has unmasked, but they give him his name graphic anyway. Cracked me up.
Because apparently you can just buy a human.
Who buys Max Mini for $587.
Seems like a low price for Max Mini.
The middleman, I don't know who this is, like Max Mini's agent, says, okay, it's okay, you can go. So Mankind picks him up like a child and then takes... So this to me is an example of something that if you take it for just face value, it's a ton of fun. If you try to really look at it in serious eyes, there is a lot of problems with it. I am someone who can just see the fun in it, but I feel like if this was to happen today, then maybe on Twitter we would have some sort of like, you know, group that would be petitioning against the World Wrestling Federation.
It is a problematic segment in a number of ways.
Would you like to list the problematic areas of it?
I mean, first of all, Max Mini is unmasked and they're just calling him Max Mini and he's just on television without his mask on. That's sacrilege.
I love that the fact that a small man is being kidnapped is not your first area of problem. Your first area of problem is his lack of mask. Okay.
No,
okay,
I'm building up.
Okay, that's fine. I apologize. I butted in. I did not let it finish.
Right. So, I mean, first of all, like, that's what first in the segment when it says Max Mini and it's like this man who's, he's not wearing his mask. And I'm just like, I feel really awkward about seeing your face. I don't like it. I mean, not that it's a bad face, but just like, you know, like luchador tradition is very important and you don't appear unmasked. Like if they would have just had him there and not called him Max Mini, that would have been a different situation. But I think like a more problematic aspect is that Mick Foley is using money to buy another human. He's not saying that he is renting the services of another human for entertainment for an afternoon. He's like, no, I have purchased this human being. This is a white man purchasing a man of color who is, you know, also a little person. And like, I don't know. I'm just not really all about the buying and selling of human beings.
I mean, you know, it's a TV show.
And also, he's infantilizing someone pretty drastically. It's the whole, like, if a midget appears on TV, they're small, so obviously they are not real humans and can't have real emotions, right? Like, they are totally like babies forever, right? Because that's basically how they treat him in this segment.
So what are your summation thoughts on the purchase of Max Mini?
I am against the purchase of Max Mini, although it was humorous. I prefer to see Max Mini in situations where he's like with Sable with laser guns and fully masked.
Max Mini got a payday here for
he did, and playing, that's good for him.
Children. So you know, every cloud.
It was just worded very strangely. If it was like, oh yes, I'm renting the services of Max Mini, or I'm renting him to come and perform for my children, then that would have been better. But he's like, nope, I have purchased this human.
It did make me laugh. It was like, right, okay, oh, so there's a midget. That's Max Mini. He's buying Max Mini. Oh, he's taking Max Mini away. Is Max Mini okay with this? There's a lot going on.
Max Mini did not. Max Mini was just kind of like, whatever.
Max Mini asked his handler if it was okay to go with Mankind. So, The Rock calls Vince McMahon. Can we just say how suave The Rock looks on this episode?
He does.
He looks like a member of The Sopranos.
Like his mock neck and his slacks.
Oh, yeah. He calls Vince. So we get a split screen of them with Vince in Texas. He complains about Mankind stealing his bounty, which would have paid for 5 new shirts for The Rock. And then he tells Vince. So Vince says, don't worry, there's plenty more money where that came from. And Rock tells Vince that he's going to take matters into his own hands.
Dun, dun, dun.
Dun, dun, dun. That then leads us to Kevin Kelly on stage bringing out Debra. Debra is... I don't know why he's going to interview Debra. Like, what's the... What is that?
I think
is,
he was going to interview her about Jeff Jarrett and Owen Hart being tag team champions.
Which, by the way, can we just say... Twice this has come up today. So Cameron Sykes on our Facebook community had said 2019 being the year of the Jeff Jarrett comeback is beyond surreal. I love it. And then we also had Ross Adams saying, where is it? Sorry, I've got the wrong Twitter up there. He's sure that somewhere, because it's been announced that Jeff Jarrett's facing Elias on Raw on Monday. He says, I'm sure Sondra is somewhere is saying, in the year of our Lord 2019, what is even happening? Question mark.
Yes, I'm definitely saying in the year of our Lord 2019, Jeff Jarrett versus Elias on Raw, what? But I'm really excited about it. Honestly, I'm not mad. I'm not mad about it at all. I think it's hilarious. And I mean, it's one of those situations where I don't think that this is going to be a large program to try to get Jeff Jarrett over as another star in the company. I think it's just kind of a guest one-off to do something fun with Elias. I'm sure Elias is going to beat him and it's going to be awesome. Like, I love it. I could not love it more. I mean, it would make more sense. Again, like, Road Dogg's the actual singer, but no one wants to see Road Dogg wrestle right now. Scott Robertson got in touch with us as well and was like, something for you to cover on the next pod. Like, he is having a match in WWE in 2019. I think we even said on Inside the Ropes this past week, because, like, I'd be kind of into it. So I'm glad it's happening. I'm looking forward to it. I will definitely be watching that match on Raw.
We get Mark Henry trying to interrupt Debra to put the moves on him. He's got to move on eventually. He's got to try and find a new lady to flirt with. But as he tries to do that, he is attacked by Jeff Jarrett and Owen Hart before referees kind of try to intervene. So, you know, I guess maybe that's a program we might be seeing. Mark Henry and D'Lo against the Jarrett and Owen Hart.
Well, it seems that way because Mark Henry, you know, trying to be sexy to Debra, and Debra doesn't look like she minds, but I mean, Debra is all about using her body to distract men for the purposes of, you know, advancing the careers of Jeff Jarrett and Owen Hart. And I mean, good for her. Like, she's good at what she does. You know, she's just kind of like, you know, this body is made for business and pleasure. And you can tell that she's just very proud of what she's achieved in her looks. And Mark Henry, I mean, bless him. Mark Henry comes off as kind of a buffoon at this point, right? He's like, ooh, a lady. I bet that I could sex her. And then it never seems to go super well for him. So maybe he should examine his choices.
Maybe he should aim for somebody older, a little bit more mature.
Or maybe at least someone who's not like, oh gosh, I just realized what you're saying.
Yes.
Yeah, that took a minute to click. I'm just like... Yeah, we'll get there.
Anyway.
I don't know how long that takes to happen.
A year.
But yeah. Okay.
About a year?
Enough time for a hand to gestate?
Oh, no. I know. It actually happens before the end of this year. So we're now in the year. Anyway, then we get Mankind giving financial advice to Kurgan.
This was my favorite thing.
And handing him some cash to invest with. Sondra, go ahead.
Okay, so Mankind is trying to explain, I believe, like, real estate or stocks to Kurgan, and Kurgan's just sitting there in his wee helmet and his tie-dye looking like a stud, right? And Mankind is not really someone that you would expect to be giving stock advice to anyone, much less Kurgan. And I love that Kurgan, you can see in this segment, he's like, I have a line, I have to say a line. And he's just like, but I don't have any money. And Mankind's like, that's okay, I've got you, Kurgan, hands him a wad of money, and Kurgan's like, oh, well, thank you. And he still doesn't look like he knows what to do with the money. He doesn't look like he knows what's going on. He's just like, do I have to go fight? Do I have to go try to kick someone in the face? Like, Kurgan has no idea what's going on with the stock market and investing in real estate. But I love that Mankind's like, no, it's a buyer's market. It's buy. Like, you know, this is what's going to happen. And suddenly Mankind has become a business guru because he has all this money. And it's amazing. And I love it.
Oh, God damn it.
Ugh. What?
I had a really good slice of cake this afternoon. I mistakenly put it on Instagram because I thought I might get a... They'd said, oh, we've got social media. And I was like, I'll put a wee picture up and tag them. I'll make a free slice of cake. My fucking personal trainer's seen it.
Well, this is... You can't put something on Instagram and then, you know, expect someone not to look at it. This
I forgot
is your
he was
mistake.
On Instagram. I forgot that. I wasn't supposed
Just,
to know.
If it's out in the public sphere, it's fair game for everyone.
I know. Damn it.
Now so, I want to see this cake, though, so I'm definitely going to your Instagram.
Up next, D'Lo Brown. It's a really good place in Glasgow. That, like, they do all these like mad wedding cakes, big tier cakes, but you can go in and buy a slice.
Oh, it's called Page.
Yeah. So,
your phone camera is really dying.
I am not getting a new phone before my upgrade. I'm not
I
doing
know.
It. So we get Jackie and Terry with D'Lo Brown in the ring. Jackie and Terry want D'Lo Brown to teach Boss Man a lesson. D'Lo objects, and, you know, haven't I done enough to make up for this? And then Jackie takes.
Haven't I done enough? You went and bought her pads one time at the store. Like,
also, but also,
haven't you done enough? She also, hasn't made you do anything.
No, no, no. He, yeah, but like, if he had actually caused her to have a miscarriage, that'd be one thing. He didn't do anything to her.
Oh, I'm aware of this. I mean, like, he was just sort of in the vicinity. So obviously, like, it doesn't make sense that she's making him do all these tasks. I still don't even understand why Terry and Jacqueline targeted D'Lo Brown as, like, the victim of their dastardly scheme or whatever.
Before we get to all the serious parts here, I just want to say this. Mm-hmm. Jacqueline is handed the microphone.
Yes, she is.
And she can't talk. She goes, D'Lo, you're going to be paying for this for a long, long time. And I'm like, right. That's her promo.
Well, her promos have always been terrible. Like, remember when she was with Mark Miro and
she
was
much
Sable
better
had to try
Sable
and
a slut, though. Because you could tell that she secretly meant it. Like,
you could.
She hated Sable, right? Whereas, like, with this, it's, so anyway, so the whole story is, I'm just going to tie this all up in one thing, because there's no point in coming back to it. So
right.
Basically, they want D'Lo to continue making up for the fact that they feel that he caused her a miscarriage, is the mm-hmm. story. So then Boss Man comes out to have this match with D'Lo. D'Lo ends up going along with it. He then is going to get the win after doing the lowdown, but then PMS get up to distract the referee.
Because they're making D'Lo have the match because Boss Man was terrible to them in the hallway, which I understand. Like, they want to get revenge.
Yes, yeah, exactly. So he's about to win, but then they get up and distract the referee. That leads to D'Lo walking straight into a Boss Man slam to lose. Boss Man then abuses D'Lo Brown with the nightstick before Mark Henry makes the save. But at the same time, Terry and Jackie are walking away very pleased with themselves. And then later on, which ties back into this, Mark Henry is sort of helping, D'Lo's being worked on by the doctor. Mark Henry's kind of talking over, going, look, you know, you've done enough. The ring isn't a place for a pregnant lady either, which is actually a fair point. It's not even a sexist comment.
That's true.
It's a fair point. Mark Henry is being sensible here. Let's just run away.
I mean, when Maryse got pregnant, she went off TV. When Maria Kanellis got pregnant, she went off TV. Like,
oh,
it makes sense.
Remind me, I have a very funny Steve Gunn thing to tell you right after this segment. But
okay.
So Mark Henry's there trying to, like, make D'Lo feel better, and he's like, you know, this place isn't for a pregnant lady. And then the doctor's like, who's pregnant? And they were like, oh, Terry. And he's like, she's never been pregnant, she's not. And D'Lo's like, don't you mess with me. And he's like, I'm telling you, Terry has not been pregnant ever. Now, you immediately had an issue with this.
Well, of course, because the doctor's like, Terry has never been pregnant, I've examined her, she has never been pregnant. And I'm like, what about Dakota? She has a daughter who's like 5 or 6 years old at this point. I'm pretty sure she's been pregnant in the past. Like, the doctor clearly meant to say, like, she wasn't pregnant at that point, but he's like, no, she's never been pregnant. She has never been pregnant in her life. And I'm like, yeah, she fucking has.
I think what he meant to say was, she's never been pregnant in the time that I have been treating her.
Yes. But that is not what he said.
He's French.
He definitely said she has never been pregnant. And I believe that she has been in the past, as evidenced by the fact that she has a daughter with gold dust.
So talk me through, though, the whole thing of they get you know, abused by the Boss Man verbally in the hallway. They get D'Lo to have a match against him because they feel that he still owes them. Then they cause him to lose, and then D'Lo finds out that she was never pregnant. Talk me up on the whole situation.
I mean, there's a lot going on here, and I hate this story, and it's so terrible. I mean, this basically is, like, you can tell that in WWF, like, women be bitches, right? Like, that's basically who PMS are, and they're just, you know, crazy women who are going to lie to you and be
awful.
It's
not an era of women's empowerment.
It's not an era of women's empowerment at all. Like, I mean, there are no women on the show who are likable, because the only babyface woman on the show right now is Sable, right? Right, I don't think there are any other babyface women on the show now that China has turned heel. And Sable, I mean, has not even been around, really, right? Are there any other babyface women? Am I missing someone?
So this Sunday,
because Luna's not a babyface anymore.
She is, I think, now, because she, well, Luna faces Jackie on Heat this coming week. So okay. I think Luna's going to be going back to being a babyface, but there isn't really anybody else.
But I mean, I'm not wrong though. Like, there's no likable woman.
There's none.
And it's all like, most of the women have this characteristic. It's kind of like, you know, 5 years ago or so when all of the women were crazy and hated each other. Right now in Retro Raw, it feels like all of the women are lying, deceptive bitches. Right. And that's because China was kind of a lying, deceptive bitch in their minds for, you know, selling out DX for the money. Terry and Jacqueline are lying, deceptive bitches. Deborah is a lying, deceptive bitch who uses her body to, you know, deceive men. So it seems to be like a very flat character trope throughout women, or throughout the roster of women on the show, because, you know, like, you have not just men writing for women, but you have Vince Russo writing for women. It is a big problem. So, I mean, we're led to believe then that Terry was not pregnant the entire time. She faked the whole thing. She told Val Venus that she was pregnant, basically to try and, like, lure him back or get back with him. Must have been her original motivation. But then, you know, Val Venus was like, I had a vasectomy, can't be mine. So then she was like, oh, well, shit, have to pretend it's somebody else's, I guess. And she never really said whose the baby was. Like, are we meant to believe that D'Lo Brown was like the father of the baby or something? Because that's not something I think they've ever indicated on Raw. So it's just like random pregnancy and we don't know where it came from, which is fine. Like, I mean, if Terry's, you know, she's single, she can do what she wants. But it's so she's been lying about it this whole time. And then she decided, oh, I know, this is the trick. Like, I'm going to have to pretend to have a miscarriage somehow. So I'll orchestrate a situation where I can get a man to believe that he was in my proximity when I fell down and he caused my miscarriage. And then I can get him to buy pads for me at the store? Question mark. Like, I just don't really understand the point of her plot and scheme.
No, I think the shock value is meant to be the miscarriage, and now they're trying to fumble some sort of story from it. And, I mean, the thing is that Terry and Jackie now come across as, like, mean bitches, which is a shame, because in the beginning, they were fucked over, so they were kind of, like, you know, women who were going to fight back against the men who had wronged them. That was,
yeah, because it bums me out, because they were such interesting characters. Like, when Mark Miro and Val Venus and Goldust had all been terrible to them, it was like, okay, yeah, like, this is a really cool kind of empowering women's group. And now it's just, nope, they're crazy and mean and hate men and are the worst. Like, they're not good people. Like, this is not something that I'm trying to spin into Terry is the babyface here. Lying about a pregnancy and then pretending to have a miscarriage is not a good thing to do. There are enough people in the world that have actually gone through that situation, and it is heartbreaking and it is tragic. And to try to use that for your personal gain is reprehensible. And I don't even understand what personal gain she's trying to achieve here, because it's just essentially to fuck with D'Lo Brown, who stood up for them. So I don't understand any of it, and the whole thing is just gross.
So then we go back to Texas, and the Stooges decide that they're going to hit on some women playing pool. Now, I want to be very careful how I say this, because I know some people, there was a thread on the Facebook community about, like, a lot of people who maybe watched this years ago just listen to the podcast and they don't watch along. Or mm-hmm. So there are people who don't watch the show, so we kind of have to be quite descriptive in how we mention things. And I feel like the women who were portrayed in these segments were deliberately of a lesser attractive stature.
They looked like people you would find in a bar in the middle of Texas who had maybe driven their children to soccer practice that day and now need a night out with some very cheap beer.
So those women had come along, and so Pat Patterson and Gerald Briscoe decide to hit on these women. Pat Patterson really tries to method act this and go for it, and then one of the women says, yeah, you're quite cute for an older gentleman, and then Pat, like, looks away and winks the wrong way but so the camera can catch it, and then somehow the woman somehow figures out what he's up to, but how could she really? And then she gives him the weakest low blow of all time. He says,
well, I think she was fucking with him. She's like, yeah, you're kind of cute, so that he would, like, try to make another advance, and then she low blows him. This woman is my hero. Like, this woman is my favorite person in all of Retro Raw on this episode, because she's so very obviously just like a lady they found in the bar or whatever. Like, she's not someone who is an actor. She's not someone who has ever been on camera before. She's like smiling the entire time. You can tell she's trying to fight a smile in the entire segment. And then, you know, gives the weakest low blow of all time with just sort of that half grin. Does a high five to her friend after she does it, but the high five is off camera because she walks out of frame. And then
Ha
Patterson and Briscoe are like, oh no, like our plan has been foiled and I wasn't able to pick up this lady, said Pat Patterson, who's never tried to pick up a lady in his life. And then you can tell the woman was like, oh, I was off camera. So she and her friend like kind of scooch back into frame and the camera moves over and they high five again because the high five was supposed to be part of it. Like, yes, we are triumphant. This segment was amazing.
It was a segment. It really
It was
was a
my
segment.
favorite thing. It was so bad,
Please
but
go
it
and
was
watch it for
amazing.
maybe the worst acted performance of all time, but also Pat Patterson again sells it like he's just lost the world title. It is amazing. But then Vince comes in. He very briefly is like, "Are you okay?" Does not care though, and says, "I found Austin." So off they go. Up next, if this show is not bonkers enough, Michael Cole tells us that a producer has requested to see what an all-male dance review would be like on WWF television. And the man that has been chosen to do this is the Blue Meanie. And he comes out dressed in very little, and does a dance, but is then attacked by Goldust, who then essentially gets in the ring and hits him with Shattered Dreams, and the fans cheer. Thoughts?
I genuinely don't even remember that this was supposed to be a dance review contest.
Oh,
Completely skipped my
no, it wasn't
mind.
a contest. It was meant to be an audition
Oh, an
for how
audition.
would male dancing be on mainstream television? The Blue
Wow.
Meanie.
Yeah, I don't know how I missed that part of the story, but I completely missed that part of the story. I mean, what I retained from this segment was that Goldust is still very angry that the Blue Meanie stole Head back from Goldust when Head wasn't Goldust in the first place. So Blue Meanie and Goldust are now in a feud because Blue Meanie did the right thing and stole Head back from Goldust so that Al Snow could be reunited with his love. Where do you even go with that?
I love wrestling sometimes.
It's just bonkers, right?
Like, 'cause it's
I like
so
the story. Like
terrible.
I said, I think I said last week, the internal consistency of this story of like stealing Head and whatnot. Like, I have no idea why Goldust wants Head. That part doesn't make sense. But the idea that Goldust wants Head, if I just accept the fact that it's very important for Goldust to have Head, then the story makes sense.
From there, we get Draws versus Kurgan. Draws is dressed like original Draws, but with like a hat. And then he like beats Kurgan in like a minute and 42 seconds. Now, I'm gonna say this because Sondra's biased, right? I am not. I don't particularly like the Odysseys anymore. I'm kind of ready for them to go away. But like Kurgan, and I did not like Kurgan when he was the big claw man either. But like Kurgan's a guy who should have been a monster character that they used in some way in a good fashion. He is not the man who should ever be jobbing to Draws, and especially not in such a weak way. This was very disappointing.
This was very disappointing, I agree. I mean, it's one thing for Draws to beat up George the Animal Steel, who's like in his, what, 60s at this point, and can barely function in life without eating a turnbuckle. But Kurgan, I mean, Kurgan should be feeling well. He should be feeling like kind of high and mighty. He has some new stock issue plans. He has, like he has plans for his career advancement and, monetary gain in the World Wrestling Federation because of the generosity of Mick Foley. So Kurgan should be walking tall here, and Kurgan's just nothing. Like, I mean, I love Kurgan with all of my heart. He is a terrible professional wrestler and one of my favorites. So, of course, it's going to bum me out to see him used like this, but I really think that, I mean, Kurgan is kind of like China. I think he could be a very effective bodyguard, and he could be someone who's like, I mean, like you said, a very effective monster killer, and they've just made him nothing. Like, he's not anything. And I know he looks ridiculous in his tie-dye and his helmet and all that kind of stuff, and I could not love him more for it, but it's a bummer. Like, I would like for him to be doing something else. And I mean, I understand why you're not super into the oddities. I still love them. Like, they're still amazing, but they're not even doing anything to the point where,
But
like, it'd almost be better if they did something else, I guess, because they just kind of seem like they're just kind of there.
the Odyssey, the Odyssey's for me, the song was what got them over, right? That was what it was. And they were the guys who should have been in short matches and whatever. But yeah, I mean, it's just kind of, the song's not there.
They fought the Headbangers for months.
I feel every time they come out, they've got less members. Mm-hmm. Luna's gone.
Draws is now taking them out, apparently. Which, I mean, is just such a cretin.
And it was really craply done.
Poorly executed.
You could see when like Draws hit him with the cane in the face or the neck or whatever, that this was going to be a pinfall. You could tell that's what they were doing. And mm-hmm. he does this like, really crap shoulder tackle, which barely touches him, and that pinned Kurgan.
I mean, like, yeah, and the thing is, Draws is, like, he's okay as a wrestler. He's not, like, terrible or anything like that. But, I mean, I guess they're just trying to make Draws look like a dick. Like, he's taking out the oddities, and it's, like, his path to domination is apparently one oddity at a time, which, I mean, I guess it's nice that they're doing something other than fighting the Headbangers, but, like, I don't particularly like Draws. I don't know why he's not in Legion of Doom anymore. None of that makes sense. There's no continuity there. And, like, I'm just not that interested in Draws, and the Oddities are my favorites, so the whole thing kind of bums me out.
I agree. So up next, we go back to Texas, where Vince and the Stooges are eating some barbecue while they wait for Stone Cold Steve Austin. Pat Patterson and Gerald Briscoe are very much enjoying the barbecue. Vince then tries to take a bit of brisket and then spits it back out, and then Briscoe calls over the waitress and proceeds to criticize her, saying, do you know who he is? He's from Greenwich, Stamford, Connecticut. You don't serve this sort of food to Mr. McMahon. And then the woman proceeds to pour some sort of liquidized food over Briscoe's cowboy hat, which was also all over his face. Sondra, what were your thoughts?
I mean, these Texas vignettes are just amazing. This was probably my least favorite one for some reason. I don't know why. It was funny to see them eat a bunch of meat, I suppose. And Briscoe definitely had like barbecue all over his face, not just from the lady pouring it on him, but because he was being a very messy eater, which is fine. When you're eating barbecue, it just gets all over, and that means you're enjoying it and having a good time. But yes, I just think the differences that they're portraying between Connecticut and Texas kind of crack me up, right? Like, in Connecticut, we would never eat this much meat or something like that. Like, I don't even know what they're doing, but it's a blast.
It's so good. It's so good.
I mean, these are amazing.
So then we get The Undertaker coming out with his Druids of Shiteness, and
Ministry is so shit.
And the thing is, but they like grossly overstate what you're about to get, because they say up next, The Undertaker is in action, which could be like, okay, he's not wrestled since Rock Bottom. That's cool. That's almost 2 months. He's a big star. I'll tune in for that, please. And instead, what we got was Midian and Viscera wrestling on his behalf against the three members of the Brood, as he sat on his huge custom chair.
Yeah, which is weird, because like it was all three members of the Brood, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then Undertaker just wasn't wrestling, so it was just like 2-on-3 for some reason, even though the Ministry should kind of be the heels, and I don't understand what's... I mean, obviously this would play into the show a little bit later on. I don't remember a whole lot about this match, other than
it was
bad.
And then the Acolytes interfere, causing the DQ, and then the Ministry...
Right.
Tears the Brood apart, and then they hang Gangrel by a noose very badly.
That I do remember, because I remember Michael Cole being like, they have a bull rope. And I was like, that is a noose. That is 100% a noose.
And
you are hanging a man by his neck.
Midian was screaming at Gangrel, die.
Yes. They are doing some murders on the television now, apparently, and I've never thought that's a good idea. I mean, that does not give you an alibi. If you're doing the murder directly on the television, then there's pretty much evidence for that. The match and the brawl were pretty terrible. I mean, I'm a big Brood fan, but seeing Midian fight Gangrel was like, wow, this is a whole new level of awful, right? Because it's Phineas Godwin versus Gangrel. And I mean, I love Gangrel and his teeth, but bless him, he is not a great wrestler.
I feel like you're slowly going to begin to love the Ministry because they're so rubbish.
I kind of already do, and I feel a little bit icky about it, but, like, I mean, you know what? I might as well just enjoy the shitness, right? Because they're so bad. Like, I mean, like I said earlier, The Undertaker and Vince McMahon are both cult leaders recruiting the outcast and downtrodden, and Vince McMahon has chosen people who are you know, like Ken Shamrock being a mentalist and the big boss man who has a nightstick and was a prison guard and is not a very effective henchman, but also, I mean, at least he's big and a boss man. And I mean, the Undertaker just chooses like Mabel and Phineas Godwin and Bradshaw and Farouk. I mean, we'll come back to the Brood.
We'll come back to it in just a moment. But before that, Mankind is walking backstage and he decides to go up and chat to Deborah and basically gives her a sweater and says she might get a chest cold.
He got her something for her boobs, he said. And she was just like, is there something wrong with them?
It was a
great
little...
I mean, this cracks me up. It's the most sincere Mankind moment. Like, all of these Mankind moments. I mean, like, I didn't necessarily appreciate him, you know, purchasing another human. But the rest of the segments on the show with Mankind are just like, he's such a sincere dope. And I love him.
We get footage of Halftime Heat again. And then Mankind comes out to celebrate his title victory. But it's obviously interrupted by The Rock. The Rock talks about... The Rock's also lost his voice. So... he's trying to, like, work through the fact that he can't be as shouty as he'd like to be. But basically, the premise is he wants his $97,000 back. Mankind says the bounty's now down to $72,000. Mankind, and then basically, he says he's not going to give it back, even though he did promise, because he's changed his mind. But he said, you know, The Rock did give him the match at Halftime Heat, so he will give The Rock a rematch. And then The Rock proposes a last man standing match, which is the first in WWF history. I mean, they are now my least favourite match, for the most part, apart from the odd people who can pull it off, but this was the first one.
I feel like Last Man Standing and, like, tables matches might still be my least favourite, but yeah, it's not my favourite stipulation. Interesting, I guess, because obviously the story's continuing with Mankind and The Rock now that Mankind is the champion. Mankind's a little bit of a dick. Like, it's a good thing he's so lovable, because it's not, like, a great thing to do to steal someone's money and then go and spend it all over the place, but I think the fact that he's spending the money on, you know, very sincere things, like helping a man with his finances, you know, Kurgan, and helping a lady not become ill because her chest is exposed in the case of Deborah, you know, buying a human, maybe not so much, but you know, it's these segments have been a lot of fun. And so it's like, I don't mind as much that Mankind stole The Rock's money, especially because The Rock did nothing to earn that money. I mean, he just like stood on a ramp and was a distraction, I suppose. He did not throw Steve Austin over the top rope. But Mankind and The Rock, this feud has actually been kind of fun. Like, I enjoyed Halftime Heat, like I said, a lot more than I expected to. And I mean, The Rock here was interesting because he's very in Rock mode. Like, this is The Rock that people think of with all the catchphrases and, you know, and it is interesting when he does the millions and then pauses and no one chants along with him yet. Because yeah. He is a dastardly, dastardly baddie, and why would you want to be a millions of The Rock's fans, right? But it was a fun promo segment, and I don't know if I really like, I just changed my mind, even though I promised I would give you this back. But it's fine. I'm going with it.
Yeah, I like the idea that The Rock said, you know, if you think what I did to the Royal Rumble was bad, wait till you see what I do to you in a Last Man Standing. Kind of just makes him more hated. It's good. It's a heel.
But like,
thing.
Stop hitting Mankind in the head. Oh my goodness.
You know, but I guess my point is, he's a heel and he's saying heel things. I enjoy that.
Oh no, that's a good thing. I just like every time I'm watching Mick Foley, I'm like, stop being hit in the head. Stop doing head first things.
Then we go back to Texas where Vince and the Stooges are at a pawn shop. Vince says that he has heard on good authority that Austin is behind this door. So Vince has a plan here. It's a great plan. He says, so he's telling the Stooges, he's like, you two better not muck this up. And he's like, I'm going to go in there. I'm going to antagonize him verbally. He's going to hit me. And then my favorite, he's going to hit me and I might go down. Like, Vince McMahon might go down. Like, he's so full of himself. It's like, it's such a good little attention to detail. That's just so good. So he says that, and he says, so, you know, I might go down, and if I do, you know, then you two jump him, and then I'll go get some help. And then they're like, we've to jump him? Now also, Patterson at this
point... always goes well for the Stooges.
Which always goes well. Patterson also has a pen behind his ear to further cement that he has a script that he's trying to remember. And he doesn't have a lot to say, which makes it even better. So eventually Vince goes in. There is a man who is... wearing Steve Austin gear, who is slightly rotunder than Steve Austin is, sitting in a chair backwards. Then Vince calls him a chicken shit. The guy has a gun. The guy is going to maybe shoot Vince, but instead...
Well, he's like, do you want a bullet? Like,
and he's like, no, I want Stone Cold Steve Austin. So they tell him the bar that he needs to go to get Stone Cold Steve Austin, and Vince retreats like a little pissy. So I thought this was great.
Well, I mean, retreating is the smart thing to do here, to be fair. The man has a gun and they're antagonizing him, which is not smart. Like, Vince and the Stooges are just not very intelligent throughout this whole thing, right? Like, they think that they're these big Connecticut men who are going to come and, like, antagonize the Texans, who they seem to just think are the savages of the land that they can control. And I think it's funny that there was a decoy Steve Austin. I'm not going to lie, when the man turned around, it took me 2 seconds to realize that it wasn't Steve Austin, because he had a goatee and, like, dudes with facial hair look the same. But yeah, like, I mean, just the guy being there, standing there with a gun, and then Vince and the Stooges just continue to antagonize him, and he's just like, would you like me to shoot you now? And they're like, no, I don't think that we would like that very much.
Yep. Another great segment. It leads us into Road Dogg and Al Snow, who've decided to team up together to take on the Acolytes after last week. The Road Dogg comes out, further proving that he is so much more over on his own. So, good call. We get this match with Road Dogg and Al Snow against the Acolytes. It goes about 6.5 minutes. I think this is probably for Bradshaw's best match I've seen him have so far, because it's not him in a ring trying to be a wrestler.
Yeah, he's just battering the shit out of people. Like, the Acolytes are the only two, like, I mean, there are a lot of chair shots and stuff in this match. Like, there's a lot of bonker stuff, right? And I figured out that, like, I don't like seeing people battered to that degree, like chair shots to the head. The Acolytes, I minded it, like, slightly less, because they're the Acolytes and I hate them so much. But I mean, this was fun enough, but it did kind of just drag on a little bit for me, I guess. And Road Dogg and Al Snow being partners is just, like, it's such a weird thing to me still, because Al Snow has a job squad, right? Like, he has a group of friends, and the Road Dogg has Billy Gunn and DX and has a group of friends. So it's just very weird to me that Road Dogg and Al Snow are teaming together, because it's like, you both have partners. It's like on at Royal Rumble when Scott Dawson was teaming with an author of pain, and I'm just like, what is happening? You have other, like, this doesn't make sense in my head. Like, you don't belong together. There is a disturbance in the force. But, you know, this was fine, I suppose. And then, you know, the aftermatch shenanigans happened, and that's what I remember a little bit more.
I thought it was fun. I like these kind of matches. They break up the show. Excuse me, a little bit for me. And I think when you've got wrestlers like the Acolytes and Road Dogg and Al Snow, then it's better to not have them doing regular matches, because they're not great at them.
It's definitely better to have them, like, brawl all over the place and find creative use of weapons than just have a match.
And in the end, Viscera ends up getting involved, because he basically throws Al Snow through some sort of cart of some kind or something.
Because Viscera and Al Snow are backstage, and Road Dogg and
Road Dogg can't
someone.
Fight off the two Acolytes. That's the problem.
Right, Road Dogg can't fight off the two Acolytes. I knew they were in two separate places.
So Road Dogg ends up getting put through a table by the Acolytes, and they pin him while Al Snow is getting beat up by Viscera, and then Al Snow and Road Dogg have this kind of... after the match, the Druids come down to the ring, they beat up the Road Dogg. So the Druids and the Ministry are all beating up the Road Dogg. Then Undertaker comes out, and the Druids are revealed to be the newest members of the Ministry of Darkness, the Brood.
Which did not take long to convert them. Like,
Undertaker's got some powers.
I mean, he's working quickly. Because when it came to Midian, it took him, like, days to, or, like, weeks,
there
actually,
was a lot
to
of convert Godwin
Midian.
A lot of Godwin to get out of him.
There was a lot of Godwin to get out of them, and apparently because the Brood lived this gothic lifestyle, they were a little bit closer to becoming ministry members anyway, because they already like blood and stuff, so maybe it just didn't take long. This is one of those things that in 1999, I know that they're just like throwing everything at you all the time at rapid pace, which, I mean, I know that you say it's bonkers and it doesn't make you bored, but it's one of those things that I could have used a week to like let digest, I suppose. And it seemed just so obvious that it was the Brood, because the Brood got so beaten up by the ministry before, and then there are three dudes, or I mean, we didn't know if they were dudes or not, but it's 1999, let's assume they're dudes, in, you know, druid costumes and whatnot. And it's like, okay, yeah, like this is going to be the brood. It wasn't that shocking. It did make me laugh though. Like Gangrel's face when they pull the hood off of him, he looks like his soul has been taken from his body and maybe he's had a lobotomy because his eyes are like a little bit crossed and he looks so, so happy about being a brood or not being a brood member, about being a ministry member now. Then Edge just looks sort of like smirky and devious, like, ha ha ha, I'm now in the ministry. Christian, and then Christian's just kind of there.
Disinterested.
He was just like, whatever, I'm going to be here in the ministry, I suppose. But yeah, I mean, the brood joining the ministry is not like, it's not super shocking, but at least Undertaker has gotten someone with talent.
Fresh blood. Hey.
Fresh blood indeed.
But then we see the Road Dogg and Al Snow arguing backstage. Road Dogg feels betrayed because he thought Al Snow was going to be there for him. Al Snow then calls him a jackass and basically they're going to fight at St. Valentine's Day Massacre for the hardcore title.
So there's a lot of like weird alliances going on and then miscommunication causing people to turn on this show, right? Because we had Billy Gunn and Val Venus earlier on where they had like just sort of that little bit of an alliance. I mean, I know that they were fighting in a match earlier on the show, but they had an alliance last week and it didn't go right. And now the Road Dogg and Al Snow are having this miscommunication and they're very upset about things. And I just feel like maybe the New Age Outlaws aren't great at communicating with other tag team partners, and maybe it's just an indication that they should be partners themselves. I'm not saying that I want to see New Age Outlaws matches. I'm just saying in storyline, like, you had a partner. Why are you not with your partner? This is not going well for you. And it's also just strange because I thought, like, Al Snow and Road Dogg are both supposed to be baby faces, so I'm not really sure who I'm supposed to root for in this.
I think in both of the scenarios, both are, Billy Gunn and Val Venus and Road Dogg and Al Snow, they're all baby faces, but they're just trying to create some sort of tension.
Speak for yourself when it comes to Val Venus.
In the story, they're all supposed to be baby faces, so they're trying to create something. I mean, it made sense to me. I thought it was fine. They created some tension between each of them. You know, I prefer Road Dogg and Al Snow having some sort of issue rather than nothing having a match. I mean, I do
just
think
a match.
I do think Road Dogg's argument is kind of problematic. Of like, he got put through a crate by Viscera. What did you want him to do? Like, it's not like he could have really done anything.
They're basically just being kind of like petulant with each other. I don't know if they're just upset because they got attacked and all that kind of stuff. But
the Billy Gunn Val Venus one works better for me. So.
Yeah, I don't know. It's just another like turn coming out of nowhere.
Well, they're not turns
like...
though. They're not turns. That's the key. They're not turns.
Tension.
Yeah, nobody's turned heel. They're all still baby faces in the story. Okay. So the only turn that we had on this show was who turned on this show?
Brood.
The Brood. Yeah, the Brood was the only turn. Although
I love when we're like, oh, there was only one turn on this episode.
Well, no, because you said there was three. So I'm just making it clear. There's not.
Oh, okay.
But the Brood one, well, the Brood one's a weird one because the ministry haven't quite made out what they are yet. Like, we don't know if they're supposed to be babyfaces or if they're supposed to be heels because they're not really fighting people that often.
But they seem like they're heels because they just keep attacking people and then recruiting them.
True.
And also they're very boring.
They are dull. They are very, very dull. So then we go back to Texas one last time. And Vince McMahon and the Stooges have tracked Steve Austin down in this bar. Vince tries to provoke him by continuing to call him a chicken shit. Austin's like, I'm not going to hit you. And Vince is like, hit me, damn it. I should also mention...
My favorite was like Patterson or Briscoe. I can't remember which one in the back going, hit him.
Patterson. And then it doesn't happen, but Austin... So at one point, Vince says, you know, you and these people, you know, and just slags them off. And then Austin says, I'm not going to hit you, but, you know, maybe these people can take up with you what you've said about them. And then Austin leaves and they all retreat. It was a fun end to a cool night of vignettes and stuff like this is stuff that I miss. I would like this back more, if possible. But then
This is loads of fun. And we get some stuff like this, but not nearly enough. I would say, like, we got more of it with, like, Fashion Police and stuff. Like,
yeah,
because,
like, remember
ago.
There was, like, the excitement of potentially Bailey and Sasha going to anger management. It was like, oh, I cared about both of them less after this.
Like, oh, because anger management was terrible. Yeah. Like, I mean, they just were like, this worked so well with Kane and Daniel Bryan, which it did. It worked, like, phenomenally well with Kane and Daniel Bryan. But you can't recreate that with Sasha and Bailey and just have them, like, I don't know. It was really terrible. But no, the segment was loads of fun. And I understand Vince's plan to get Stone Cold Steve Austin to hit him. Like, that is a logical thing, but I don't think it was very wise of Vince McMahon to try and execute that plan in Texas, where Stone Cold Steve Austin is beloved and he's around a bunch of Steve Austin's friends, right? Like, if you're going to a bar and there are loads of people around, obviously they are not going to be on your side. And you see the ending coming a mile away, right? Like, Stone Cold Steve Austin doesn't need to hit Vince McMahon. He hates Vince McMahon, but he also wants to get his hands on him at St. Valentine's Day Massacre. So, of course, he's going to get all of his friends from his local establishment to beat up Vince McMahon on his behalf, which is just intelligent reasoning by Stone Cold Steve Austin and proof that Vince McMahon's hot-headed emotional anger has once again foiled his plans.
One of my favorite things on this show is they had a promo for Valentine's Day, for St. Valentine's Day Massacre, and they're like, Valentine's Day, a time to tell someone how you feel. I hate Austin! I hate Austin! It was so good. Oh, I loved it. It was so funny.
It was amazing.
Basically making it that the Austin and Vince are going to consummate their love affair in a steel cage at St. Valentine's Day Massacre.
It seems that way. Can you imagine? Like, that would be the angriest hate fucking of all time.
Even more angry than you and Dolph Ziggler.
I am not. I'm not hate fucking Dolph Ziggler. Ugh,
you so
to
want
sun.
To. You so want to. Anyway.
You have this theory in your head. I do not agree.
Of course you're not going to agree, because that would make you look bad. It's one that I can imagine you having, like, a sort of very secret masturbation to him one time in your life over a hate fuck, and just being like, okay, I've got it out of my system. It's done. I can go back to hating
him. No, no,
no. I say, well, we'll just install CCTV in your house and make sure.
Nothing could possibly go wrong there.
Yeah, that's totally fine, right? Main event time is a steel cage match with Triple H versus Kane. Kane being part of the corporation, Triple H being part of DX. so they have this match, and I just thought it was pretty fun. Overall, the dynamics of Kane. Kind of more fighting for China rather than fighting for the corporation. And Triple H obviously fighting for what happened last week. And in the end, the crowd are continuing to kind of rally behind Triple H, but X-Pac prevents Kane from getting at the door by slamming at his face, which obviously is kind of a long-term story, because X-Pac was the one that had said to Kane, don't be in the corporation. They don't care about you, you know, and then Kane just hit him anyway. So there's a backstory as to why he came out and slammed the cage door in his face. Then China runs out. She's trying to keep Triple H from getting out. Triple H kind of kicks her away, and by the time she gets back up, he's just got over the top so he can get out. Fans go crazy for the finish, and China then gets on the mic post-match and says, because Kane's going to go after them, and she's like, Kane, just let them have this one. But Triple H, it'll be me and you at St. Valentine's Day Massacre. Happy Valentine's Day, sweetheart, as the show goes off there. So I'm curious, what did you make of the cage match, the aftermath, and the potential Triple H and China match at St. Valentine's Day Massacre?
I mean, the shenanigans are fun. I thought the match was super boring, I'm not going to lie. Like, I did not enjoy it. There was so much punching and kicking, and a Triple H versus Kane match is not what I really needed to see in my life. But I think it picked up definitely once China and X-Pac got involved. I do like the storyline continuity of X-Pac being involved, because he really, like, he is the most sympathetic member of DX and also the one who's been screwed over the most by Kane and China. Because he was just trying to be a good dude when he was, you know, trying to get Kane to join DX and was like, let's be friends. And Kane apparently thinks the corporation, who calls him nasty words, is better for him for some reason. I mean, like, he needs to escape his traumatic situations. But I like X-Pac slamming the door in Kane's face. I like China getting involved. I think this segment was proof that gear is not ideal for wrestling, because it was not incredibly supportive and she had to, like, fix it a whole bunch, which I don't know, it's just something I notice a lot. But I like her, you know, grabbing Triple H's foot. I still, like, I understand her rationale as to why she, like, turned on DX and stuff. It's still kind of just weird and jarring to me, because I don't look at Kane and believe that he's super loyal to the corporation, especially because they treat him so poorly. And I don't necessarily look at China and, like, believe that she's going to be super loyal to the corporation either. So I guess it's still just taking a minute for some of the storyline aspects to gel in my head, so I can be like, right, so I guess they are corporate now. And it's just, like, it's a little bit jarring to watch. But I mean, the storyline stuff makes sense and all of the characters make sense. It's just, I do not like Triple H at all. I think he's so boring. So his big triumphant win did not feel big and triumphant to me, because I do not like him and I like Kane better. But I am intrigued by what China means. Like, it's going to be you and me at St. Valentine's Day Massacre, because it doesn't seem like they would want to build to a Triple H versus China match at St. Valentine's Day Massacre. I don't actually know what happens, so I guess I will tune in next week to find out. But China's a fascinating character right now, and they're definitely building the show around her. Like, this show is making me understand why, like, as a child, I knew who China was. I knew that she was a wrestling lady. And of course, like, growing up the way I did, it was like, she looks like a man. But no, she's fucking awesome. And I love China. She's great.
It's funny because I've asked a few people this week about the Triple H and Kane match, and I think a lot of it's got to do with genuinely new fans watching, old fans watching, because I think a lot of people, when we were kids in the 90s, like, punches and kicks and stuff wasn't what a wrestling match was about. It was about atmosphere and the vibe and the characters. And I think there's just this thing sometimes that will happen where, like, I could watch 205 Live for hours and be bored. Just really bored, because it's just move. And there's nothing for me to really get into. Whereas for me, I grew up on it not being about the in-ring wrestling. That was never what it was about. And I think a lot of people who watched in this era, and maybe some of the disconnect a little bit, is that, you know, for us, it wasn't about, right, okay, how much of a five-star match can people have? How great is the match going to be? It was just, are we invested in the characters and what they're doing and the crowd and the vibe and all the different elements that go into it? And I think that's just kind of a difference. And I think it would be, I think if I was watching wrestling, if I'd started watching wrestling in 2011 when CM Punk came around or whatever, and then tried to watch this now, I don't think I'd have the same feeling for it that I have as an old school fan. And I think that's been
definitely makes sense. And I have a lot of forgiveness when it comes to, like, vibe and atmosphere and that kind of thing. Like, I really like, you know, a big atmosphere kind of match. I mean, like, I enjoyed Sid versus Vader, and, like,
I'm not trying to, like, pick apart you not liking Triple H and Kane. I'm just trying to say, I think sometimes there are people who are long-term fans who kind of go, oh, I really enjoyed that match. Like, was it that boring? And I'm trying to just, I think that's where the disconnect sometimes comes for people.
Well, and I think some of the disconnect for me personally too is, I mean, what you're saying, there's an atmosphere and it's about being invested in the characters, right? Now, I like Kane fine, but I don't know that I would say Kane is one of my favorites on Retro Raw right now, because he's just, like, in the corporation and I want him to be out of the corporation. And then there's Triple H, the big boring void of charisma that he is. So it's not just that, you know, there aren't enough moves, and the crowd was super into this. So it was one of those things where I'm like, I'm listening to a crowd and I'm so happy that they're enjoying it, but I just can't. And it's kind of a double-edged sword of, like, the moves are not exciting, and also I'm not into Triple H at all. And so it's just not necessarily for me.
That package is not going to combine for you.
No.
Okay, overall, so this episode, what did you think of it overall? Where is your thumb?
I think there was some stuff that was so fun, and then there was some, like, just dross. I think it's a thumbs in the middle show, but no, it's a thumbs up, because Texas and Mankind and shenanigans and stuff, I don't know. Well, no, I'll just give it a thumbs up because Texas.
Yeah, I think it's a thumbs up show. I think this is one of the examples. This is, like, a good, if you've not watched the Attitude Era before and you go, would it be for me? This is a kind of example of what you would get, like, as an average, I would say. Like, this isn't, like, the best that they've done, it isn't the worst that they've done, but this is kind of what they would do most of the time. So, if you watch this and it's just not for you, like, completely, then this era just might not be for you. But I thought there was enough on it to get a thumbs up. I thought that all the storyline stuff made sense, the Texas stuff was amazing, the Mankind Rock stuff was featured pretty well, I thought some of the undercard stories were pretty good. I still am baffled that Blue Meanie's supposed to be a dancer.
I just love the internal consistency of a story involving a stolen mannequin head.
1999, ladies and gentlemen. Sandra, what are the plugs?
All right, find me on Twitter at SandraRuthRW. Find Kenny on Twitter at KennyMC1985. Follow Inside the Ropes at Inside_the Ropes. Join us on Patreon, patreon.com/InsideTheRopes. Tons of bonus content. Hear us talk about Royal Rumble 1999. Hear us talk about Royal Rumble 2019. All sorts of stuff going up there all the time. YouTube.com/InsideTheRopes for tons of interview content. And also the live reaction to the Royal Rumble 2019 that happened at Kenny's home, which I thought was a blast to watch. Also go to InsideTheRopes.co.uk. /Goldust for tickets to An Evening with Goldust at the beginning of March.
Very, very quickly, a couple of notes I'd forgot to say that I'll get through in just 2 minutes. This particular week, there was a convention for like media and stuff to talk for advertisers, and Vince McMahon had this quote when he was talking about Ted Turner. He said, where the fuck is it? I had a line and now it's gone. was about Ted Turner. He basically said that he hopes Ted Turner dies. Is essentially Vince McMahon's message. Oh, here it is. Wait a minute, I've got it now. He said... Ted Turner. Yeah, okay. He said, talked about WCW. They can't compare to us. The only thing they can do is throw negatives and grenades. They're nasty people. I don't like them. Ted Turner can go to hell. I hope one day he does.
Oh, boy.
And Eric Bischoff said, where I draw the line is stuff that's of a sexual nature, the homophobic type of things that are out there, things that are religious or racially based. And a lot of it was kind of like, you know, Vince was like, we don't do crucifixion. We didn't do castration. And our language isn't anything worse than you'd see in primetime TV. It was a whole thing. Next week's Raw is going to be live from the Sky Dome in Toronto, Canada, home of WrestleMania 6 and WrestleMania 18. Dan Severn is on his way out. He was given the option. He was given two choices. He was given the option of signing a contract release where they'd give him a severance check, or he could remain in contract for the next year until it expires, but he would be jobbed out for the year that he stays with the company. I don't know if you heard it on commentary, Sandra, but the WWF Music Volume 4 was number 24 on the Billboard 200.
I mean, oh, okay.
Insane. The top 200 albums in America, WWF were number 24.
That is crazy.
Sable was apparently at this point going to be beginning to be phased out as a wrestler, where she would be wrestling occasionally in gimmick matches, which is what they tried to start doing, but obviously then she ends up leaving.
How can you phase out Sable as a wrestler? She's had like three matches. I'm sorry, I'm just baffled by this.
February 7th, 1999's episode of Fox's That 70s Show featured The Rock, Ken Shamrock, Ernie Ladd, and the Hardy Boys. Oh, good lord.
I've never seen that episode.
Austin, Rock, and Mankind will be three of the four featured in TV guide covers in March. And... all at a critics convention, Steve Chow of the USA Network responded to criticism of the WWF by saying, "The issue to me is very simple in business terms. Is the show antisocial and does it send a bad message? And I unequivocally have zero problems with the show." So, ratings are good, they're staying.
Excellent.
Who's playing us out?
Let's play the Brood's music.
Here's the Brood. They're gothy and they're in a ministry. Bye.
Bye.